Well, I'd like to thank Philadelphia Society and Bill Campbell as well for the invitation. Bill had asked me to speak on American pragmatism as it relates to progressivism. And the way I want to do that is to look at Richard Rorty as sort of the logical culmination of pragmatist thought, and really progressivist thought, too, but in particular of John Dewey's thought. And I do think there is a there's an important distinction to be made. I think there was a real fault line, a division among the founders of pragmatism that is often not appreciated. I wrote about this. Half of my book actually is about Jamesian pragmatism. Jonah Goldberg had mentioned last night, and I think he was right about the pernicious tendency of the moral equivalent of war. And Jay Langdale had quoted the apparently damning statement of James that ideals ought to aim at perpetual transformation of reality. But I just wanted to mention quickly before I look into my paper a couple of quick points about James that that suggest a different direction that pragmatism could have gone. First of all, James thought the question of existence, the why question, classically formulated as why is there something rather than nothing, and why is the something what it is rather than something else, he thought this question was a practical imperative, the practical imperative of the question of the ultimate ground of being. He kept at the center, which Dewey did not. He explicitly abandoned that question as unfruitful to practical success. Secondly, James spoke in his Moral Philosopher and the Moral Life of the necessity of the idea of eternal moral order to any genuine ethics. Third, in Principles of Pragmatism, Principles of Psychology, his magnum opus, he spoke of conscience as a sense of divine expectations, which he spoke of in terms of an ideal spectator. And fourth, he spoke of order always in the making, which is not inconsistent, I think, with Eric Vogelin's notion of order in terms of Aristotle's right by nature. In fact, I don't think it's inconsistent with Strauss's understanding of what Leo Strauss's understanding of what politics should be, an approximation as much as possible of right order, which will necessarily take different forms in different historical circumstances. So it's really Dewey, I think, who's the villain. Dewey was Rorty's hero, explicitly. So to the paper, I've entitled this The Core of Progressivism. The analysis of progressivism's core Eric Vogelin gave 6 decades ago in his New Science of Politics remains, I think, the most illuminating. That core is the Christian idea of history gutted of spiritual substance and turned from its original destination. The original idea, classically articulated by St. Augustine, was that human history, the human history that really counts of those who love and follow God, is a pilgrim's progress to a perfect city, a journey with no map and no guide but God himself, to a mysterious place not of this world. The classic symbolization was Abraham's quest when, on hearing the call, left his old home in Ur of the Chaldeans for a land that God would show him. The great modern ideological formations, Vogelin said, progressivism, utopianism, and revolutionary activism, all were moved by a similar vision. But God has been dropped out of the picture, and the process has become a quest for political perfection in this world to be achieved not by gods, but human hands. When the ends and means are clearly laid out, as by Marx, The result is revolutionism. When the final perfect state is stressed, but with no clarity about the means of getting there, the result is utopianism. When the movement is stressed without clarity about the end, the result is progressivism. All these movements involve, along with a new interpretation of history, attempts to create new bases of authority, new human standards, and ultimately new men and a new reality. The fourfold existential structure recognized by the ancients of God, man, society, world remains in place, but the parts have been reinterpreted, or sometimes, in God's case, replaced with something else. Richard Rorty confirmed the thesis thoroughly and profoundly in his Lectures on American Progressivism, published as Achieving Our Country, up to and including the religious character of the movement. Rorty's thought is exemplary of progressivism to a degree no other intellectuals I can think of has been. It represents a progressivism fully conscious of itself, fully aware of its presuppositions and implications. And Rorty made those presuppositions and implications explicit. His analysis of progressivism is therefore invaluable for helping us understand the essential meaning of the thing. The essence of Rorty's philosophic and political project, for him, philosophic and political are not distinct categories, is the establishment of a new civic religion, his words, grounded not in God, but in a thoroughgoing secularism, and involving, he says, new conceptions of what it is to be human, of human community, man's relation to nature, and human authority. He wants a world in which, he says, nothing save freely achieved consensus among human beings has any authority at all. His vision is utopian, his word, but not in Vogelin's sense of the term. There is an imaginary ideal of a kind of society sought, one in which, in particular, selfishness and sadism, as he calls them, economic and psychological evils, respectively, are things of the past, and diversity of self-creation is embraced. But Rorty assumes society will never cease to evolve, that human happiness will take forms unimaginable to us today, and keep taking new forms indefinitely. Rorty understands this project as progressivist. He uses the word leftist and grounds it in a quasi-Hegelian view of history, in historicism, his work. Historicism in its purest form, the form Rorty adopts, presupposes that nothing is eternal and that there are therefore no constants by which man and history may be measured. It means most fundamentally, Rorty says, the temporalization of ultimate significance and of awe, which requires rethinking old conceptions of God and reality, and thus of man and society. The meaning of life, he says, is a function of how human history turns out, rather than the relation of that history to something ahistorical. Human meaning is not, as Plato and the Christian said, in any sense a product of man's relation to something eternal. It is all right if some people believe it is, but they should keep such beliefs to themselves because any public embrace of them would get in the way of progressive goals. It is possible a progressive can believe in eternal ideals toward which we should be progressing, as Lincoln, for instance, though he was no progressive in the strict sense, thought we should try to progress toward ever closer approximations of securing everyone's natural rights, securing their enjoyment, that is. But the progressive tendency is to reject or abandon eternalized ideals as too restrictive, getting in the way of personal and social self-creation. Religious progressives incline relatively more to the Lincolnian view of the secularists than the secularists, and God may be for them a powerful motivating factor. But even for religious progressives, worldly concerns tend to eclipse any concern for the spiritual formation of society. And indeed, the concept of social spiritual formation would be unintelligible to most of them, as it is for moderns in general. Spiritual development for them tends to be radically individualized. Practically speaking, the progressivist kingdom, even for religious progressives, is emphatically of this world. A consistently historicist view of history means either that God is not eternally the same, or that he has no part in human affairs, or that there is no God. Rorty prefers the last option, but in practical terms, the effect of any of these assumptions is the same. There are no fixed standards, his word, by which human beings may regulate their lives. Rorty himself is certain that to get on with progress, we need to learn to do without God, as he says in Consequences of Pragmatism. The reason is that taking God or God's servant seriously means accepting human limits. No past human achievement, Rorty says, not Plato's or even Christ's, can tell us about the ultimate significance of human life. No such achievement can give us a template on which to model our future. The future will widen endlessly. Experiments with new forms of individual and social life will interact and reinforce one another. Individual life will become unthinkably diverse and social life unthinkably free. The moral we should draw from the European past, and in particular from Christianity, is not instruction about the authority under which we should live, but suggestions about how to make ourselves wonderfully different from anything that has been. Self-creation is the central value, and acknowledging a divine creator or taking your life as established in a divine ground of existence, Rorty's word, makes you dependent, makes self-invention a futile and even self-destructive enterprise. As the title of his lecture suggests, Rorty is especially interested in specifically American progressivism, and he recasts the American experiment in progressivist terms. Despite the patent theism of the Declaration of Independence, references God four times, twice as one involved in human affairs, and its obvious debt to the past, British and colonial political traditions, and on Jefferson's own account, past political thinkers, including not only Locke and Sidney, but Aristotle and Cicero. You see his 1825 letter to Henry Lee. Despite all this, Rorty appeals to that document, ironically, as betokening an Easter dawn of secularism and radical futurism. Following Walt Whitman, he makes the significance of the Declaration's founding of America that it was, in Rorty's words, the first thoroughgoing experiment in national self-creation, the first nation state with nobody but itself to please, not even God. We are the greatest poem because we put ourselves in the place of God. Our essence is our existence, and our existence is in the future. Indeed, like most American progressives, Rorty does not seem to think much about much of what America presently is, which is part of the reason he and fellow leftists are so eager to change it. Their talk is always of what it could be. The left, Rorty says, sees our country's moral identity as still to be achieved rather than as needing to be preserved. The right, he says disapprovingly, thinks that our country already has a moral identity and hopes to keep that identity intact. He clearly wants to preserve leftist achievements, but these achievements are seen as overcoming old American bad habits, the selfishness of the capitalist and the sadism of the religious moralists. The America that is, except for the journalist, reform activist, and what Rorty calls the secular churches of the elite universities, is very religious, capitalist, loosely speaking, and reverential of American traditions. The loss of spiritual substance involved in the immunization of Christian hope is evident in Rorty's formulation, "Our existence is in the future." That is, we don't exist now. When our deeper spiritual urges are not satisfied, our lives, if we don't give up on them, are in the future. We can only hope that life will come someday, and because non-existence is hard to bear, we must strive constantly to make that day come. This is part of why Voegelin takes revolutionary activism to be the purest form of modern ideology. The existential emptiness tends to make people impatient, and people less easygoing of temperament than Rorty are liable to get desperate. The order of things has to change, and we have to change it now. In short, the progressive ideologue has lost his soul. Since the soul, or more precisely what Aristotle called the immortalizing part of it, was in the old way of thinking what made man man, the progressive has to make a new man. With no eternal anchor, the man will be fundamentally changeable. But for changeability to be a really good thing, he will have to be perfectible. There being no fixed standard for human perfection, he will be infinitely perfectible. Which sounds pretty good until you realize it means empty, aimless, endless striving, always becoming and never being anything. This is Rousseau's man, and a kinder and gentler version of Nietzsche's Man of the Future. For political purposes, progressive man needs a new moral identity. But what kind of moral identity? First of all, one not constrained by any notion of sin. The only sin for progressive man, here already quotes Emerson, is limitation. This understanding of evil, Rorty says, was basic to the progressive movement in American politics and to its confidence in education and social reform. Let me skip to the end here. When the substantive hope of faith disappears, the replacement hope is invariably political. Human beings need a connection to something greater than themselves, as Rorty admits, and the only thing greater than the individual man in a world with no God is, unless you become a very radical environmentalist or animal rights activist, human society. The desire for heaven doesn't disappear when God is rejected, but heaven becomes an earthly objective, and there being no God to make it, we must make it. And Rorty talks about this explicitly. The relative aimlessness of progressivism as compared to pure utopianism and revolutionary activism is, in a certain sense, its saving grace. Since there is for the progressive no definite worldly end of history, there is less need than utopians or revolutionaries for the ruthlessness and violence against those unbelievers who block the way to heaven. And so it's a progressive left is more tolerable than a utopian or revolutionary left. And yet, despite its comparative mildness, progressivism seems inevitably to lead to authoritarian government, both in its means and its end result. With respect to means, since the people are too large to meet and act together and are mostly too dim to see the need for or desirability of doing without God or remaking traditional government and society, progressive action will have, at least in the beginning, to be the province of smart people. Smart people, of course, if they're really smart or progressives, who should be given the means of to attack suffering on behalf of the people. If the people don't like what the progressives want, the progressive agenda, as with the recently passed Obamacare program, will have to be forced on them for their own good. The end may be democratic, but the means, as with communism, have to be authoritarian. And one last paragraph. But it is hard to conceive any end state that is not authoritarian as well. The end state is not likely to be a hard despotism in which dissent and independent action are crushed with an iron fist. But how it could escape Tocqueville's soft despotism, I cannot imagine. How could selfishness and sadism possibly be eliminated by political means, assuming they could be eliminated, which seems highly dubious, without the government experts regulating every detail of our lives? And would the social and economic equality achieved be worth the sacrifice of free will? Indeed, in the end, unchecked progressivism would seem destined to kill the very creativity it most craves. So progressive success would come at the cost of humanity, not only in the Greek and Christian sense of humanity, but in the progressive sense as well. Perhaps the Greeks and Christians were right after all, that really living requires dying to self, and that only truth can make you free. Thanks.